She by Henry Rider Haggard. In giving to the world the record of what, looked at as an adventure only, is, I suppose, one of the most wonderful and mysterious experiences ever undergone by mortal men, I feel it incumbent on me to explain what my exact connection with it is. And so I may as well say at once that I am not the narrator, but only the editor of this extraordinary history. Some years ago, I was stopping with a friend at a certain university, and was one day much struck with the appearance of two people going arm in arm down the street. One of these gentlemen was, I think, the handsomest young fellow I have ever seen. "Good gracious," I said to my friend. "Why, that fellow looks like a statue of Apollo come to life." "Yes," he answered. "He is the handsomest man in the university. They call him the Greek god. But look at the other one, too. He's Vince's, that's the god's name, guardian. They call him Charon." I looked and found the older man quite as interesting in his way as the glorified specimen of humanity at his side. He appeared to be about 40 years of age, and was, I think, as ugly as his companion was handsome. I remember saying that I should like to know him. "All right," answered my friend, "nothing easier. I'll introduce you." And he did. And for some minutes we stood chatting. I remember being rather amused because of the change in the expression of the elder man when he saw ladies advancing. I heard afterwards that he was popularly supposed to be as much afraid of a woman as most people are of a mad dog. I cannot say, however, that young Vincey showed much aversion to feminine society on this occasion. That same evening my visit came to an end, and this was the last I saw or heard of Charon and the Greek god for many a long day. But a month ago I received a letter and two packets, and on opening the first found that it was signed by Horace Holly, a name that at the moment was not familiar to me. It ran as follows. "My dear sir, you will be surprised to get a letter from me. Indeed, I think I had better begin by reminding you that we once met, now some 5 years ago, when I and my ward, Leo Vincey, were introduced to you in the street at Cambridge. To be brief and come to my business, I have recently read with much interest a book of yours describing a Central African adventure. This has given me an idea. It happens that my ward, or rather my adopted son, Leo Vincey, and myself, have recently passed through a real African adventure. To tell you the truth, I am almost ashamed to submit it to you for fear lest you should disbelieve my tale. We had indeed made up our minds not to make this history public during our joint lives, nor should we alter our determination were it not for a circumstance which has recently arisen. Under these altered conditions, it has become a question whether we are justified in withholding from the world an account of a phenomenon which we believe to be of unparalleled interest. After much discussion, we have come to a compromise, namely, to send the history to you, giving you full leave to publish it if you think fit, the only stipulation being that you shall disguise our real names. And now, what am I to say further? As regards she herself, I have nothing to add. Who was she? How did she first come to the caves of Kor? We never ascertained, and now, alas, we never shall, at least not yet. Will you undertake the task? Read the manuscript and let me know. Believe me, very truly yours, L. Horace Holly." This letter, as may be imagined, astonished me considerably. But when I came to look at the manuscript, I was still more astonished. I wrote to this effect to Mr. Holly, but a week afterwards received a letter from that gentleman's lawyers, with the information that their client and Mr. Leo Vincey had already left this country for Tibet. Well, that is all I have to say. Of the history itself, the reader must judge. I give it him, with the exception of very few alterations, exactly as it has come to me. There are some events of which each circumstance and surrounding detail seems to be graven on the memory in such fashion that we cannot forget it, and so it is with the scene that I am about to describe. It was in this very month, something over 20 years ago, that I, Ludwig Horace Holly, was sitting one night in my rooms at Cambridge. I was to go up for my fellowship within a week. At last, wearied out, I flung my book down. As I was in the act of lighting a pipe, I caught sight of my own countenance in the glass. "Well," I said aloud, "it is to be hoped that I shall be able to do something with the inside of my head, for I shall certainly never do anything by the help of the outside." This remark will doubtless strike anybody who reads it as being slightly obscure, but I was in reality alluding to my physical deficiencies. Short, thick-set, and deep-chested almost to deformity, like Cain, I was branded by nature with the stamp of abnormal ugliness, as I was gifted by nature with iron and abnormal strength and considerable intellectual powers. And so, as I stood and stared, and felt a sort of grim satisfaction in the sense of my own loneliness, there came a knock at my door. I listened before I went to open it, for it was nearly 12 o'clock at night. I had but one friend in the college, or indeed in the world, perhaps it was he. Just then the person outside the door coughed, and I hastened to open it, for I knew the cough. A tall man of about 30 came hurrying in, staggering beneath the weight of a massive iron box. He placed the box upon the table and then fell into an awful fit of coughing. I poured out some whiskey into a tumbler and gave it to him. "Why did you keep me standing there in the cold?" he asked pettishly. "I am done for, Holly. I do not believe that I shall see tomorrow." "Nonsense," I said. "Let me go for a doctor." He waved me back imperiously with his hand. "It is sober sense, but I want no doctors. Now listen, we have been friends for 2 years. Tell me, how much do you know about me?" "I know that you are rich and have had a fancy to come to college long after the age that most men leave it. I know that you have been married and that your wife died, and that you have been the best friend I ever had." "Did you know that I have a son?" "No, I have. He is 5 years old. He cost me his mother's life, and I've never been able to bear to look upon his face in consequence. Holly, if you will accept the trust, I'm going to leave you that boy's sole guardian. I have known for some time that I could not last, and since I realized the fact, I have been searching for someone to whom I could confide the boy and this," and he tapped the iron box. "Listen, the boy will be the only representative of one of the most ancient families in the world. You will laugh at me when I say it, but my lineal ancestor was an Egyptian priest of Isis, though he was himself of Grecian extraction and was called Callicrates. In or about the year 339 before Christ, Callicrates broke his vows of celibacy and fled from Egypt with a princess of royal blood who had fallen in love with him, and was finally wrecked upon the coast of Africa. Here they endured great hardships, but were at last entertained by the mighty queen of a savage people, a white woman of peculiar loveliness, who, under circumstances which I cannot enter into, but which you will one day learn, if you live, from the contents of the box, finally murdered my ancestor, Callicrates. His wife, however, escaped to Athens, bearing a child with her. 500 years or more afterwards, the family migrated to Rome. 8 generations later, his lineal representative crossed to England. From that time till the present day, I can trace my descent without a break. 10 years ago, my father died. Then it was that I undertook an expedition in connection with that, and he pointed to the iron chest, which ended disastrously. On my way back, I travelled in the south of Europe and finally reached Athens. There I met my beloved wife. There I married her, and there, a year afterwards, when my boy was born, she died. My marriage had diverted me from a project which I cannot enter into now. I have no time, Holly. It was necessary, or at least I conceived that it was necessary, that I should attain to a perfect knowledge of Eastern dialects, especially Arabic. Very soon, however, my disease developed, and now there is an end of me. I have never seen my boy, Leo, since he was a tiny baby, but they tell me that he is a quick and handsome child. In this envelope, and he produced a letter from his pocket addressed to myself, I have jotted down the course I wish followed in the boy's education. I could not entrust it to a stranger. Once more, will you undertake it? I must first know what I am to undertake, I answered. You are to undertake to have the boy, Leo, to live with you till he is 25 years of age, not to send him to school. On his 25th birthday, your guardianship will end, and you will then, with the keys that I give you now, open the iron box and let him see and read the contents and say whether or no he is willing to undertake the quest. There is no obligation. As regards terms, my present income is $2,200 a year. Half of that I have secured to you by will for life. The rest is to accumulate till Leo is 25, so that there may be a sum in hand should he wish to undertake the quest. For my sake, Holly, we have been good friends, and I have no time to make other arrangements. Very well, I said, provided there is nothing in this paper to make me change my mind. And I touched the envelope he had put upon the table by the keys. Thank you, Holly, thank you. Swear to me, by God, that you will be a father to the boy. I swear it, I answered solemnly. Very well. My will be found among my papers. Goodbye, my friend. And with a sudden access of tenderness, he flung his arm about me and kissed me on the forehead, and with the word, remember, on his lips was gone. The whole thing baffled and puzzled me to such an extent that I determined to sleep over it. As it seemed to me, I had only been asleep for a few minutes when I was awakened by somebody calling me. Why, what is the matter with you, John? I asked of the gyp who waited on Vincey and myself. You look as though you'd seen a ghost. Yes, sir, and so I have, he answered. Leastways, I've seen a corpse. I've been in to call Mr. Vincey, as usual, and there he lies, stark and dead. Of course, poor Vincey's sudden death created a great stir in the college, but as he was known to be very ill, there was no inquest. For a week after the funeral, I heard no more, and indeed my attention was amply occupied with my fellowship. At last, however, the examination was over, and I came back to my rooms and sank into an easy chair. As I sat, there was a knock at the door, and a letter in a big blue envelope was brought in to me. It read, Sir, our client, the late M. L. Vincey Esquire, who died on the 9th instant in Cambridge, has left behind him a will, of which you will please find copy enclosed. Awaiting such instructions as you please to send us, we remain, sir, faithfully yours, Geoffrey and Jordan.